spending growth after inflation is not as strong as it was, but it's still there. You know, it's still growing, and it's growing at rates that were similar before the pandemic. And so the consumer's hanging in there. There's other parts of the economy that are having real problems.
You're listening to Carrie Lutz's Financial Survival Network, where you get valuable information you just can't find anywhere else. To thrive in today's trying times, you need the Financial Survival Network now more than ever. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and get your free newsletter and gift. Financial Survival Network, now more than ever.
And welcome. You are listening to watching the Financial Survival Network. I'm your host, Carrie Lutz. Well, hey, economy, it looks like it's imploding, or maybe it's a slow motion implosion right before our very eyes. Housing down in many areas, auto sales, economy, interest rates. We got Wolf Richter with us now from wolfstreet.com. Wolf, great to have you back on. So what do you make of the economy now?
Hi, Gary. Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting economy, and I've never seen anything like this. Yeah, the consumer is still hanging in there. The consumer is still swimming in money, and so they're still spending, which is a problem for the Fed because, you know, they're trying to get inflation down, and so they're raising interest rates, and the consumer is not cooperating. So now we've got high interest rates that are really hurting the banks. We already had a handful of them implode, and they're stressed. Many other banks are stressed, so that's an issue. So that's a financial system that is now struggling. And then on top of that, of course, we have this uncertainty about the U.S. default. So meanwhile, the consumer is just blowing it all off and just spending money hand over fist.
So it's the Alfred E. Newman economy. Remember him? What, me worry?
Yeah.
Yeah. So how long does this go on for till the consumer starts facing reality?
Well, we've seen some layoffs, but these people that have gotten laid off in the tech and social media sector have gotten rehired pretty quickly. And sometimes outside of tech and social media, there are lots of other companies that look for talent of this type. And so we really haven't seen the big increases in unemployed people, you know, so that's not happening yet. And it's going to eventually happen, maybe, you know, but it hasn't happened yet. So that's the income stream of many Americans, and that's still holding up. They've gotten the biggest pay raises in for decades, and they're working. And so, you know, that's doing pretty good. And then, you know, you have all these other people, the retirees and others that live off their fixed incomes. And, you know, you're talking about $20 trillion in treasury bills and money market funds and in savings products. And they're now making 5% income, you know, on their money. And they made 0% essentially a year and a half ago. So they're starting to spend this money, and this is propping up spending too. So we've got all this stuff going on the spending side, in terms of consumers, and we haven't seen any disruption to that yet. Yeah, spending growth after inflation is not as strong as it was, but it's still there. You know, it's still growing, and it's growing at rates that were similar before the pandemic. And so the consumer's hanging in there. There's other parts of the economy that are having real problems. Yeah, the banks, we talked about that from a minute ago. Companies are having trouble, riskier companies are having trouble refinancing the loans. We've got the whole sector of commercial real estate, particularly office and now apartments and some other parts, you know, that are getting into serious trouble. Retail and commercial real estate has been in trouble for years. Yeah. So, yeah, there's other parts of the economy that are really struggling.
Yeah, so it's kind of an interesting phenomena. And then there's sections of the country that are struggling more than others, right?
Yeah, and it really depends on where you are. And the economy is always local, and real estate is always local, and small businesses are always local. So, I mean, the big companies are global. And you know, so when they talk about the layoffs, they're talking about global layoffs. A lot of them don't even happen in the United States. So it doesn't really impact us here. So that's a global thing. And but your small businesses, you know, they're local and they have local customers, and you know, restaurants have local customers, and so they're depending on the local economies. And so in some places, when I live in San Francisco, the place is hopping, you know, despite all the layoff announcements and all the empty offices and all this stuff, you know, people are spending a gazillion tons of money here. And there's tourists and from all over the place. So, you know, that part is still there. And in other parts of the country, you see some bigger weaknesses cropping up. Some places never had any growth to begin with. I mean, so yeah, that's just how it is.
Right. Well, in Miami, in Florida, it's exactly the same. It's booming. Houses are still selling. But housing is definitely taking a hit in large swaths of the economy. What's your take on that?
Yeah, and it's regional too. I mean, like you said, Miami is probably, or in Florida generally, probably in much better shape in terms of housing, or further behind, let's say, than the West Coast, the entire West Coast, particularly California, Seattle, Portland, big coastal cities there are getting hit very hard on housing. And you know, they've been overpriced for years. In San Francisco, we've lost a good part of the population, and there's all kinds of stuff on the market. Now prices have come down substantially in the entire Bay Area. They're starting to come down in Southern California. They've come down a lot in Seattle. I mean, these are big price declines we're looking at, double-digit price declines. And now we've got spring selling season. So at the moment, you know, everybody's got into this, okay, prices are going up, but they're going up seasonally. You know, they always go up. They went up during housing bust one during this time of the year. And the other parts of the some other markets have gotten hit pretty hard too. And it's just sort of spreading from there. Mortgage rates on Friday the daily measures we have were back close to 7%. So for the average 30-year fix, so that's 6.9%. And you know, these home prices in a lot of places don't make sense at 6.9%. It just it's just too expensive. And for deals to happen, the prices have to come down.
Hey, what about commercial real estate? You got empty skyscrapers all over the country. I mean, my kids have embraced it, the hybrid workplace. They go to work 2-3 days a week. The rest of the time they work from home. Hey, if you're raising a family and you're a single mom or father or two working parents, this is the greatest thing that ever happened to you. But not so much for commercial real estate. It looks like we're looking at trillions of dollars of commercial real estate that will have to be repurposed in some way or form. Perhaps they'll all become Tesla factories.
Yeah, that would be interesting. You know, I'm kind of long-term, you know, I'm pretty positive about this because these downtowns that are full of business buildings that, you know, they empty out after hours and they become, just devoid of people, and they're not fun to be in, and it doesn't matter where or when. You know, these financial centers are really not a good place in a sense. And so cities that have embraced mixing office buildings with residential buildings, these central business districts suddenly become pretty lively. And so I think that's the future. You know, they're going to have to convert some of those office towers that can be converted. You know, talking about older buildings, a lot of them cannot be converted. You know, they will be sold in a foreclosure sale for land value, essentially, and be torn down and replaced by a residential tower. And, you know, this is all very slow moving. And we're talking years, you know, and so this is not happening today. I mean, they're talking about it. They're starting to some conversions. I mean, conversions have been going on for years, but it's just hard to convert a 1980s office tower into residential. It's almost impossible. It's just cheaper to tear it down So there's some buildings where that works. And so, but it's, you know, tearing down a building and building a new one, that's good for the economy. You know, it's a lot of investment, a lot of spending. And so that when that starts to happen, that'd be a good thing. Meanwhile, we've got investors, so equity investors in these buildings, and we've got lenders in these buildings, and they're going to lose their shirts. And there's just no way around it. It is spread all over the place. It's, so far, the big defaults that we have that I've looked at, these big towers, you know, they were all investors, not banks that were on the hook. So these are commercial mortgage-backed securities, mortgage REITs, and private equity firms, and other specialty lenders, life insurance companies, you know, that are on the hook for them so far. And, and investors, equity investors, lose their portion first. So far, that's who's gotten hit, and it's spread all around. It's global. I mean, these are global investment funds. These are global bond funds and pension funds that have invested in the equity and in the debt of these office towers. And, you know, there's just no way around it. An older office tower is worth the land value, essentially. You know, that's what we're learning. And one of them sold in San Francisco. You know, we finally had the first post-pandemic sale going through of an office tower, and they cut the price by 75%, and it sold. You know, that's what you have to do. You know, to sell an old office tower, and it was a usable office tower, and it had a tenant in it, that's how, you know, and it was a lease back arrangement. The bank sold it. There was no lenders involved. It didn't involve any losses for lenders, and that kind of set a market price, 75% off, and that will probably probably be a working model going forward.
Okay. So, you know, I could see that. I remember reading the story of Massachusetts Mutual foreclosing on the Chrysler building. I don't remember the exact dates, and they sold it for hundreds of millions of dollars at some point in the future. I was in an office building in Manhattan that they foreclosed on, and I never saw if they sold it again. But they foreclosed for like $12 million. Building is probably worth a couple hundred million. It was a historic high rise. So definitely opportunities are there. They found that like in lower Manhattan, a lot of these older buildings that were office buildings were actually really perfect for conversion because of the dimensions, more so than new buildings, because they were a set number of feet from the elevator core. So there was very little internal space on these buildings. The newer ones that have like 100,000 square foot floors, not really that suitable for residential, because you got all this interior space that won't have windows. And that just, it's good if you're an artist, an art studio, or you have a sound studio in your house like me, but otherwise not so good. But I guess it's going to get digested, is your point. A lot of institutional investors hold the mortgages, and they'll be the proud owners of this property at some point or another. What about the auto industry? Now, it looks like sales have been heading downward for everybody but Tesla and a few EV makers in China. But one analyst I talked to recently forecast that Tesla will not be able to withstand the flood of Chinese imports. I'm not buying it. Being a Tesla owner myself, I just don't see the driving experience being equal in the Chinese cars. I could be wrong. What's your take on what's happening there and interest rates and repos and all of that?
Yeah, so in terms of the EV thing, yeah, we have Ford come out today and say that prices will have to come down by about 5%, in part because of Tesla's price cuts. And Tesla has, and that is very uncommon in the auto industry, you know, Tesla has built and is continuing to build production capacity in large amounts. I mean, they just opened a plant in Texas. They opened one in Europe. They're looking at new plants. They've got this huge plant in China and got the plant in California. They're looking at opening new plants in Mexico and in other places in Asia. And so they're continuing to ramp up the capacity. And in order to make that work, they have to sell a lot of vehicles. And and they had the largest profit margin of the main automakers, you know, so they can't afford to cut prices. And they're going out there and they're trampling all over these legacy automakers. And I think that's great. Now, I'm not a huge fan of Tesla, but I think the strategy is just amazing. I have come to hate the legacy automakers for the stupid decisions they have made over the years. And, you know, they have ignored EVs for a decade. So now Tesla is a decade ahead of them. They can't get the supply chains together. You know, Ford's got a couple of models out, but it can't build them in large quantities because it doesn't have the supply chains to do that. And, you know, they're going through all the problems Tesla went through 10 years ago, or 5 years ago, you know. So now they're trying to catch up. GM doesn't have anything, really. You know, it's talking about what it's going to have. And the one vehicle it has, the Bolt, it's shutting down. So there are other EV makers out there like Volkswagen and the Koreans, you know, that are doing a much better job, and they're providing some pretty stiff competition. Of course, in China, like you said, there are hundreds of EV makers, and some of the big ones, some of the big companies are being very competitive, and they have to compete on price. So they cannot compete on cool factor with Tesla, and they'll have to compete on price. And that's what it comes down to in the United States. Now we have this. For the first time in many, many years, we've got a new entrant, essentially Tesla, shaking up the oligopolistic behavior of the legacy automakers. And I think that is great. And right. You know, auto prices have gone up so much, so fast, that the average American can no longer afford a new vehicle. So there's something seriously wrong with that strategy. Everybody's gone upscale. The average transaction price of a new vehicle is now $47,000, which is just ridiculous. You know, when you look at average incomes, you know, and so, something needs to happen. And Tesla came along and is now shaking them up, and that is good, and it's having a big impact. You know, and that's why EV sales and a lot of other EV makers have followed suit, so they've cut their prices. And in California now, we're looking already at an EV market share of 20%. So, I mean, that's huge from out of nowhere, really, you know, and it's not just Tesla anymore. Now there's 40 models on the market. And so even though Tesla is number one, and the Model Y and Model 3 are now the number one and number two bestsellers in the state, blowing away Camry and other models. And, you know, so the automakers are going to have to react to this. Toyota doesn't have anything really to speak of in the EV field, completely dropped the ball. And so that's the biggest movement in the auto industry I've ever seen. It's a shakeup. You know, it's really good for industrial America, I think, because a lot of these EVs and the technology is being built in the United States. I think this is a great thing to happen from an industrial point of view, from an American industrial point of view. And I think the price cuts are a great thing to happen from a consumer point of view. I think it will be tough going for the legacy automakers. So, you know, a fight like that is tough to deal with, and so that's one aspect that's really working. And I'm surprised with how suddenly it took off. You know, and it was just gradually going, and now suddenly we've got this sort of massive momentum behind it. We're going to get some imports from China that are going to shake up the pricing situation further. So that, I think that's a good thing. The bad thing is for consumers, you know, interest rates have doubled for autos. You know, that's just how it is. And so it's getting a lot more expensive to pay for these expensive vehicles. And, you know, there's a huge amount of pent-up supply out there. There's like 4, 5, 6 million vehicles that haven't been bought over the last 3 years because of the supply shortages. People have inventory. Now we've got inventory. Now there's pickups and there's SUVs and all kinds of stuff everywhere. Except some of the import makers don't have a lot of inventory, but the domestic brands all have plenty of inventory, and deals are being made. Automakers are subsidizing the interest rates on the car loans. So Ford Credit offering 3.9% on pickups and that kind of stuff. So, they're going to have to fight to get their internal combustion engine vehicle sales up. They're way down. They're in the levels of the 1970s. You know, we haven't seen those kind of sales figures in many decades, except during the peak of the financial crisis and during the lockdowns. Yeah, you know? So these are really bad sales figures on ICE vehicles and market share is being eaten up by these EVs. So, you know, the industry has is being really shaken up by this now.
Right. So, I just see it. They're totally caught flat-footed, like Mary embarrassment there over who runs a GM, saying that they're going to overtake Tesla by 2025. And, you know, she said that a couple of years ago and everyone laughed, but it was ridiculous on its face. The charging infrastructure that Tesla has constructed, they just opened one literally down the street from my house here. That's the demand. Like, I don't use it that much because I charge at home, which is another nice thing. Whether the grid can handle the increased demands of EVs, that's something I guess we'll find out in the next few years. They'll have to build.
So when do you charge up your vehicle?
I charge it in my garage, you know.
And, at night, right?
Yeah.
And yeah. So see, that's the thing. You know, most people that own EVs charge them at night. That's when the electricity is cheaper if you have time of use billing. And that's when there's huge excess capacity in the grid. And so these EVs that are being charged at home at night are just using up excess capacity, you know, and idle capacity, you know, that's just sitting there and it's expensive. And electric utilities, they're loving EVs. They're absolutely excited about this because now they can sell electricity at night when really people haven't been buying electricity. And so I think the strain on the grid will be a lot less because of that, because it just, it will even out the load. And it won't be all, yeah, you won't be, and these EVs won't be charging in the middle of the afternoon when the ACs kick in. Yeah, they'll be charging when the electricity is cheaper, which is in the middle of the night, most of them. And so, you know, I think the strain on the grid will be manageable. Also, all the electric utilities, when they see that they have growth in revenues, they can invest in the equipment and infrastructure, in which, yeah, which they really couldn't before because they couldn't justify to investors because their sales weren't going up. And so now that sales are going up, electricity sales, you know, they can invest and issue long-term bonds to build equipment. That's how the model works. And they're back on a growth model. Since 2022 was the first year the United States broke out of its electricity consumption pattern. It's stuck in for 15 years. So for the first time, we have a major increase in electricity sales in 15 years, you know, and that's a good thing in many ways, you know, for utilities. They're not scared of that.
Well, the fact is that a kilowatt produced at high noon cost the electric company about five times more than a kilowatt produced at midnight. Mm-hmm. Assuming it's not air conditioning season and you don't have this massive heat wave going on. And the fact is that when you're in time of use billing, they charge you five times more for that day kilowatt, or maybe in Florida, it's four times more. And they don't, you know, it costs them 3 cents to produce a kilowatt at midnight, and they charge you 7 or 8 cents. So they're really like not passing that savings on to the consumer. I mean, one thing, having an EV, I've learned to geek out over my electric bill to figure out like how I do things as cheap as possible using time of use billing. But hey, so summing up, things are bleak for the legacy auto manufacturers, but for the up and coming ones, Tesla in particular, a select few of the Chinese, because they're not going to be able to build service organizations globally. Only a few will be able to do that. You know, your XYZ electric car company that's in, you know, Shenzhen province is just not going to be able to have a service network. Cars, regardless, still require a lot of service. So only certain companies can really do that, right?
Right. But there's also hesitancy among American consumers to buy unknown brands with little representation. So you end up with a vehicle or the car maker then pulls out and the retail value crashes, resale value crashes, and you can't get it serviced and you can't get parts and stuff yet. Parts. So, I mean, that's a problem a lot of startups have. Once the cool factor vanishes, you know, most people they look at a vehicle as transportation that needs to be reliable, and they need to be able to sell it when they want to, and they need to be able to get it fixed when they need to. And so I think a lot of these startups will just not make it. Yeah, there'll be a big shakeout, and a lot of these smaller companies will vanish. And And the big legacy automakers will eventually get their stuff together, but yeah, you know, they're just years behind, and they just handed Tesla the market and say, "Oh, go run with it."
Yeah, hey, it's like basically owning one of these Chinese no-name, we used to call them bastard brand cars, will be like owning a Saab after they shut the company down. You're like, got a few years there, maybe, if nothing bad goes wrong, and you hope that you'll be able to find the parts from a scrapyard, but it's not exactly confidence inspiring for sure. So, and Tesla says they're going to build by the end of the decade 20 million cars a year, which is a feat that has never been accomplished even by the likes of GM or Toyota. That's going to be interesting to see.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see if they can actually sell them. I'm pretty sure they can build them, but selling them, that's another thing. You know, once you get to these numbers and a few years down the road, you know, there are some automakers that are starting to make a lot of progress, you know, like Kia and, yeah, and Hyundai and Volkswagen and others, you know, some of the Europeans. And they're going to eventually fight back. And so then it will come down to price now. I mean, this is why I'm so excited about EVs, because we finally have a disruptive company here that will shake up this pricing oligopoly we've had.
Yeah, and they've just been screwing us. You know, the guaranteed price. Look what they did during the pandemic. Prices of pickup trucks are $100,000 and more. And they didn't get that much better in the, maybe even a little worse during the pandemic. You know, what about this full autonomy? I mean, I love the FSD, but it's like basically you're driving with your 16-year-old who just got their license, except that Tesla has a lot more confidence than that 16-year-old. And I'm telling you, if you just let it steer you in the direction it wants all the time, you'll be in an accident. There's no question. On the other hand, I've had two instances, one where it's pitch black at night. I'm going on the road. There's street lights, but not very, they're really spread apart. And it's a divided highway. The car hits the brakes and I'm thinking, oh, okay, great. Phantom braking again. And then I see a bicycle shoot across, right across where I was going, basically save that person's life. The other time it happened almost the exact same situation, but pedestrians in an unlighted area ran across the street. The car hit the brakes, like not quite panic stop, but it hit it well before I even recognized those pedestrians were crossing. Do you think this is like the unobtainable full self-driving automated autonomous driving?
Yeah, so the things that you mentioned are they're widely available now, and even heavy trucks have those emergency braking systems now, and they're working. You know, you have adaptive cruise control, you have all kinds of things that regular cars now have that are actually far from driverless autonomous driving. You know, and we in San Francisco have cars driving around, robo taxis driving around without driver picking up people. You know, and on an experimental basis by the automakers, and these are fun stories to read where a bunch of these crews robo taxis suddenly pause up into an intersection and stop and block traffic for hours, you know, and those kinds of things. You know, I'm amazed how well they are doing. I'm amazed that anybody can come up with a vehicle that drives on its own through the chaotic traffic of San Francisco, and they're doing it. Yeah, so this come a long way. Obviously, we're like 10 years behind schedule, but eventually this technology will probably work. And I am personally looking forward to having, you know, not even owning a vehicle anymore, just subscribing to something that picks me up when I need a ride, you know. I've been looking forward to this forever, and it's going to be many more years probably before this is a functional technology that's widely available at a reasonable price. The human drivers are really bad. And so, you know, this is the thing, you know, robot drivers only have to be better than human drivers, but that's not how the human equation works. We think the first person that gets killed by a robotaxi is like a national catastrophe. and we're killing, you know, 35,000 people in traffic fatalities every year. So, you know, human drivers are horrible. And yet, you know, for self-driving, for autonomous driving to take off commercially, it needs to be near perfect. That's a high bar to pass. And I agree with that. You know, I don't want to get run over by a driverless vehicle. That would just be really embarrassing.
Yeah, who are you going to sue?
Yeah, that's right. Exactly.
It's a problem. So, but interesting. I mean, yeah, every time there's a Tesla crash with the autopilot, which is amazing, I have to tell you, it's adaptive cruise control on steroids, steers the car. It's like nothing. You get to a place, you're relaxed. It takes a lot of the burden of driving off, I have to say. You know, drive to Miami, you're there relaxed, 80 miles away, relaxed. So I think it's going to take a while, though, because we're a ways from fully autonomous, because the thing has to be programmed to recognize a situation. It doesn't think ahead. Like, hopefully, if you're a defensive driver, you're always thinking ahead, what's going to happen here. All autonomous can do at this point is react, right? It doesn't predict.
Yeah, I'm doomed to look forward to the technology for many more years, probably, before it's wildly available.
All right. So, hey, interest rates and the economy in general, like you said, it's a tale of two cities, if you will. But has the Federal Reserve gotten to the point now where the system's broken and they're going to have to cut rates? And if that's the case, how much impact will it have?
Yeah, so the system, meaning the financial system, you know, it's struggling with these higher rates, and it's struggling with them because these managers back then made some really stupid decisions in buying these long-term treasury securities and mortgage-backed securities when rates were really low. And, you know, the bond market was in complete denial about this, and we started getting bigger inflation in late 2020, early 2021. They kept buying these long interest rate securities. And so now they've got the stuff whose market value has now dropped, and then they'll be worth face value when they mature. But until then, maybe 10 years or 20 years from now, until then, they have to deal with market value, and that has dropped a lot. And so for banks, you know, this is a tough environment. There was a long time, you know, there's this notion that rising interest rates would be good for banks because the banks would still not pay any interest on their deposits, so they would get this free money and they could charge higher interest rates on their loans, so their interest rate margin would become wider and they would make more money. And that has turned out to be a fallacy. That has turned out to be complete BS that has been spread for years. That, in fact, deposits are leaving when banks are not paying any interest on it. They're leaving to money market funds. They're leaving to treasury securities. They're going somewhere else. And when the deposits are leaving, banks run out of funding and they collapse. And that part of the equation has turned out to be wrong, and the other part got misjudged. And, you know, so now we've got this issue, and the banks are going to get through it mostly, and there'll be some that won't. And they'll have crummy earnings. Yeah, because the interest rate margin will be squeezed as the deposits are leaving, and especially the regional banks and the smaller banks. Yeah, they have to offer high interest rates on their deposits, and that brings the costs up. And so the earnings will be squeezed. They'll be bad for investors, you know, and they'll be, we always lost some banks just about every year. Yeah, so it's not unusual for there to be some bank collapses, and there will be more. In terms of the rest of the system, you know, it's really doing fine. You know, I mean, the economy can live with 5% interest rates. It's just fine. We'll see that. You know, we'll see inflation come down a little bit. Maybe it has come down a little bit, but it's getting sticky around that rate. And, you know, consumers are still spending. Businesses are, some of the riskier loans are starting to pick up again. You know, so after a period of adjustment to 5% interest rates, you know, the economy will muddle through this, and that's a bad sign for inflation. Yeah, because, you know, we've got this inflation that's set in, the economy is still generating demand, so that's still, you know, fueling inflation, and there's this excess money out. So I just don't see a rate cut by this year. You know, the The short-term bond markets are not seeing it either. You know, when you look at the six-month yield, it's figuring in another rate hike and no rate cut this through the majority of the year. And, that would have to be a significant decline in inflation before the Fed would cut interest rates. So else it gets completely out of control, you know, and they're aware of that. And we went through that in the 70s and 80s where it completely got out of control. And, you know, the dollar got hammered and all kinds of problems were going on. And nobody wants to think about the housing market with 18% mortgage rates. So, I think the economy right now is adjusting to these higher interest rates. And, in terms of stocks, in terms of bank stocks particularly, I think this is tough sledding. You know, real estate stocks, I think it's really bad. I mean, there's a lot of other stocks out there that are going to have a real problem. But the financial markets really aren't the economic system. You know, they're just kind of doing their own thing. And we've had a really crummy economies with booming stock markets, and we can get a pretty muddled through economy with a stock market that's in really bad shape, and that could very well be a possibility given the valuations we now have.
All right. Well, I think it's interesting what we're going through here, and hopefully we're not going to see double digit interest rates again in the near future. Perhaps with Europe's banks are in worse shape than the U.S.'s banks. One thing I find interesting is Jamie Dimon said we're not taking over these failing banks. And that's going to last about 5 minutes till the next one comes, because it's going to be like Merrill Lynch and Bank of America, where Ken Lewis said, we don't want Merrill Lynch. And the Treasury, the Fed say, hey, Mr. Lewis, you are now the proud owner of Merrill Lynch, but we don't want it. No, you didn't hear us right. You are now the proud owner, and that's what's going to happen. The big banks will have these failing regionals crammed down their throats, whether they like it or not, on very attractive terms, I might add. They're going to wind up with them, so they might as well just bite the bullet now. Whichever ones fail, further consolidation, right?
Yeah, and I think there will be some pressure on the other bigger banks. I mean, even some regional banks to absorb another regional bank if it's not that big. Yeah, there's some pressure on the banks that are not JP Morgan, you know, to provide competitive bids, and they just they have to provide competitive bids, and then they get the bank, you know, but it's. You know, I mean, looking at a bank over a weekend and deciding whether you want to buy it or not, I mean, that's a gamble.
Well, you know, they always get a backstop, though, from the Fed and from the Treasury. We take all the bad stuff, you get all the good stuff as of this cutoff date, and you're off to the races. But going to be interesting. So, hey, go over to Wolf's site, wolfstreet.com. It's must reading. You get insights into these types of issues you're just not going to find anywhere else. And hey, if you've got a question for Wolf or myself, shoot me an email, kl@kerrylutz.com. And you can click right through to Wolf's site on the show notes to this interview at financialsurvivalnetwork.com. Just click sign up for our free newsletter. Wolf, always a pleasure. We'll talk to you again soon.
Thank you, Kerry.
Thanks for listening to Kerry Lutz's Financial Survival Network, your solution to today's trying times. For the latest, go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com. Financial Survival Network, now more than ever.